This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says politicians would serve the public better if they played more to the center. It's a position Schwarzenegger has had to know well. He's a Republican in a very blue state. Schwarzenegger claims bipartisanship really isn't that hard, and he asks why Washington can't work that way. Schwarzenegger talked about reaching across the aisle in a recent speech at the National Press Club, and it's that speech we'll hear today on Word for Word. While Californians may hear him a lot, the Press Club session was Schwarzenegger's first major national speech since the 2004 GOP National Convention. For other politicians, this might be seen as a run-up to a run for president. But Schwarzenegger can't seek the highest office because he wasn't born in the U.S. It has, however, been pointed out that he could run for the U.S. Senate when his current term as governor ends in 2010. But Governor Schwarzenegger hasn't said what his future plans are. Arnold Schwarzenegger came to the States from Austria after winning the Mr. Universe title in 1967. His success as a bodybuilder helped launch a career as a Hollywood action star. He became a U.S. citizen in 1983, and 20 years later became governor of California. Last year, he was reelected. Here then, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger speaking last month at the National Press Club in Washington.
Now, most people love speaking here at the National Press Club to follow the footsteps of Roosevelt and Churchill, Mandela, and so on. Me, I'd just like to get one of those windbreakers that you give to speakers when they talk here. So thank you very much for inviting me. We really appreciate it very much. You know, after I spoke about bipartisanship and post-partisanship in my inaugural address, it was amazing. It was really amazing the kind of reaction that I got, the kind of letters that I got from around the world, and it made news stories around the world. I think there's such unbelievable political division out there that when someone just simply talks about working together, that it becomes newsworthy. Certainly the voters in California like to see the idea of the elected representatives working together, and this is exactly what we have done last year. And I think the results were very clear the day of the election. 91% of Republicans voted for me, and a huge number of Democrats also voted for me. As a matter of fact, that's what made me be 17% ahead of my opponent. But the interesting thing also is that two-thirds of Californians now say that the state is going in the right direction. Now, that's quite different than just 3.5 years ago before I was elected, where we had 72% of people say the state is going in the wrong direction. And for the first time in 10 years, the approval rating of California's legislature is higher than their disapproval rating, the first time in 10 years. So it's very clear that the people like the idea of both parties working together. Now, here in Washington, it's quite the opposite. But last year in California, we have gotten so much done in spite of being an election year. We reformed prescription drug costs, passed the world's most comprehensive plan to reduce greenhouse gases, and we began rebuilding the state's infrastructure. We did it by just simply working together. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't claim to be Gandhi or anything like that, because I contributed in 2005 to polarization myself. I tried to hold a special election, which we did, and I tried to pass some of our initiatives, but the ideas were good, but the way I went about it was the wrong way. And it was too much about us versus them, and I just made terrible mistakes. Now, I'm not a person that gets all introspective about my failures, which there is only a few, but I do know when something doesn't work. And dividing people does not work. Now, here, but division in is what Washington has come to represent. For too long, this town has been about divide and conquer. Find an issue that splits our country in half, then crack it just enough so you can come out ahead. I have 51%, you have 49%, I win, you lose. But something larger gets lost in the process. That is the public's trust, public's respect, and the public's faith in government. After an initial flurry of hope, it doesn't look like anything has changed here in Washington. The same things are happening all over again. I mean, what is the point of stirring up bitterness over non-binding resolutions? Or what is the point of each side preventing the other side from conducting a vote? The point is, of course, political advantage, because it's definitely not to the public's advantage. All of this energy is being spent on bitterness. All this effort is being spent on maneuvering and trying to win and make the other person the loser and so on. Imagine if that same energy were put into working together to build a consensus. Think about that. The wings of each party, of course, say, we have our principles. Why is being principled reserved for the extremists? The left and the right don't have a monopoly on conscience. We should not let them get away with that. We can be centrists and be principled, and we can seek a consensus and retain our convictions. What is more principled than giving up some of the part of your positions to advance the greater good of the people? That is how we arrived at our Constitution of the United States. I mean, our founding fathers would still be meeting at the Holiday Inn in Philadelphia if they wouldn't have compromised. Believe me. Why can't our political leaders today do the same thing? Some people say, Arnold, haven't you sold out and become an independent? No, I am still a proud Republican. I support the guiding principles of the Republican Party, like lower taxes, a strong defense, free markets, and the belief in the power of the individual. Whether you're Republican or Democrat, you don't have to give up your principles at all. But isn't the ultimate principle to serve the people, to do the things that are good for the people? We are elected as public servants, not as party servants. When I talk about working together and centrism and post-partisanship, some people dismiss it as saying, yeah, this is just some of the lightweight idealistic ideas that Schwarzenegger has. Yes, Schwarzenegger, Edmund Burke, Kennedy, and there's so many others that have talked about this idea. Edmund Burke said that all government, indeed, every human benefit and enjoyment, every virtue and every is very prudent and is founded on compromise. John Kennedy called compromise the art essential to keeping our nation united and enabling our government to function. Politics is about compromise. It's about give and take, and it's about trading. Doesn't anyone here in Washington remember that chapter from the civics book? I mean, that is an important one to go and restudy. Postpartisanship, however, is not just simply Republicans and Democrats each bringing proposals to the table and then working out the differences. Postpartisanship is the new concept of Republicans and Democrats giving birth to new ideas together. Corporations say all the time that the more diverse the team, the more creative and the better the solutions. Now, I come from the private sector. I can tell you that is absolutely accurate. And the same creative approach should be the goal in politics. And this is why I have in my administration Democrats and Republicans and decline the state and independents. Should we not have new ways of working to reflect the new iPod world? It all starts with something, of course, very basic, and that is by establishing relationships. Now, I read where the president asked a senator about his son who is in Iraq. The senator's dismissive reply was not in the spirit of the question. How did that reply advance the public's good? Now, in the courtyard in our state capital, I have a politically incorrect smoking tent. I don't know if you have heard about that one. People come in there, Democrats and Republicans, and they take off their jackets and rip off their ties, and they sit down and they smoke a stogie and they talk and they schmooze. So I ask myself the question, how come Republicans and Democrats out here don't schmooze with each other? You can't catch a socially transmitted disease by sitting down with people who hold ideas that are different from yours. I mean, I tell you, my parent-in-laws, for the last 30 years since I've met Maria, I've been over to the house, and they have people invited over that are Democrats and Republicans. And they have wonderful discussions talking about the Peace Corps and about Special Olympics and then slowly bridging over to policy and to politics. And sometimes they agree and sometimes they don't agree. But you can disagree with your opponent and still maintain respect. When I spoke at the Republican convention in 2004, I told them how I became a Republican because of Richard Nixon. Now, you should have seen. I mean, it was like the end of the world. I mean, some people were really angry. They thought that by me mentioning the president who had resigned in disgrace, that I had in some small way rehabilitated him. Now let me tell you a story that is related to this. In 1977, over the Christmas holidays, Senator Hubert Humphrey, as he was on his deathbed and at his home in Minnesota, began calling old friends and colleagues, supposedly to wish them a happy holiday season, but actually to say goodbye. On Christmas Eve, he also called Richard Nixon, the man who had defeated him for the presidency. He found both the Nixons ill and depressed in San Clemente. Senator Humphrey was so troubled by this that he actually called Nixon back the next morning. And he said he didn't have long to live, and he already had made funeral arrangements, which included lying in state at the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. And he invited Nixon to attend that ceremony as an honored guest, befitting the rank of a former president. Now, at that time, Nixon was still the object of great animosity and had not returned to Washington since his resignation 3 years earlier. According to an eyewitness, many people gasped when they saw Nixon come in and took his place. And in the photos, you can see actually him and President Carter sitting there in the front row before the flag-draped coffin. What political grace and human compassion Humphrey showed. Where is that world gone? Where has that world gone? And how can we get it back? And what bridge do we really have to cross in order to get there? I believe that we can start by simply just talking to each other, working with each other. Now, after years of sharp division in California, we are consciously trying new approaches in order to solve problems. It can be done. My smoking tent is always very, very busy, I can tell you. And sometimes there is white smoke coming out and sometimes black smoke. Now, one big issue that we are trying to work on right now is, for instance, healthcare. The problem is so pressing that we got together and we said, hey, we can't wait for the federal government anymore, so let's do it ourselves. We are in the middle of that process right now, and here are the politics of the situation. Part of the plan that I put on the table provides coverage for children of undocumented immigrants. My fellow Republicans oppose this. They are appalled by this idea. Well, I totally understand their opposition, because after all, doesn't it encourage people to come here legally and stick California with their medical bills? Well, the fact is that we have no choice about paying the medical bills of people that are here illegally in California. Federal law requires us to treat anyone and everyone that shows up at the emergency room and needs care. So we have absolutely no choice, none whatsoever. So the question really is not, should we treat them or not, or should we cover them or not, but the real question is, do we treat them in an emergency room at 3 or 4 times the cost of a doctor's office or a health clinic, or do we treat them more efficiently and more cost-effectively? I say let's recognize the realities of the situation and deal with it practically. Well, my Republican colleagues just have a problem with this idea. Now, of course, the Democrats have their own problems with my health care proposal. It provides individual mandates, which requires personal responsibility. I believe that part of the healthcare answer is mandatory medical insurance, just like we have mandatory car insurance. A lot of Democrats say that individual mandates are unfair. My position is that people who don't take responsibility for themselves end up costing other people a lot of money. Now, of course, we have to take care of those that cannot afford health care. And this is why my proposal says that those that are in poverty of 300% would be taken care of by our state. So these are the kind of things that we are trying to work out and that we are working through. And I'm absolutely confident that this year we will work through that and we will have health care for everyone in California. So far, everyone has maintained their cool and maintained their good attitude. No one is calling anyone any names, which is, by the way, big, big progress. And this is the kind of dynamic that I like to keep in all the things that we're talking about. If it is the environment, if it is healthcare, if it is infrastructure, if it is water, energy, and all of those different areas, we want to do the same thing, both of the parties working together in the right way. Now, in the interest of time, let me just mention one final area where Republicans and Democrats must work together on, and this is immigration. We in California cannot do this by ourselves, otherwise we would. The nation's borders are the federal responsibility. Now, one side says, send all the illegals back where they came from, and let's build a big fence. The other side says, no, this is bogus. Forget about that. Let's give everyone amnesty. Hey, I have an idea. What about being realistic and just actually solving the problem? So there is a totally reasonable centrist approach to this whole thing. And this is this. Secure our borders while at the same time recognize the economic and social reality by providing guest worker programs and giving everyone citizenship who is already in the country and meet a certain criteria. Now, this is a mainstream solution, very simple. And it is time that we reintroduce the concept of mainstream back into the American political life. And the place to start with is immigration. Now, here in the state's capital, I ask the federal government to come together and to pass comprehensive immigration reform. The votes are there. Is the willingness to work together for the good of the people there? That is the question. And I hope for the sake of the country that it is. Someone must start rebuilding the trust and the relationship in this town. There are very simple ways to begin. To the Democrats, I say, stop running down the president and just tell the people what you would do. And to the Republicans, I say, stop questioning the motives of the Democrats in the war and accept their right to believe in what they want. And to the president, I say, get yourself a smoking tent. And to all, I would say, remember that the majority of the people in this country are in the center. Ladies and gentlemen, in closing, let me just tell you what I told the citizens of California. I believe that the political way forward is look to the future, look to the center, and look to the dreams of the people. Thank you very much, and now I'm ready to take some of the questions, and then I'm going to collect my windbreaker, okay? But thank you very much. Thank you.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is the Republican governor of California, and he spoke February 26th at the National Press Club in Washington. You're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After his speech, he took some questions from the audience, as read by Press Club President Jerry Zaremski.
First of all, someone asks, you are very well known for having made this shift from a more adversarial to a more cooperative relationship with the legislature. How did you go about rebuilding your relationship with the legislators?
I think that they recognized that my ultimate goal was exactly what their ultimate goal was and is, and that is to serve the people of California. They knew that, you know, I was not as experienced, that I had a great first year where I went through a honeymoon period where a lot of things got done, including workers' compensation reform, which is saving businesses now $13 to $14 billion in California, and like you said, to rebuild the car tax and all of those kind of things. But, you know, when the honeymoon period ran out, then all of a sudden it got more difficult, and it became a different ballgame. And I did not recognize that quick enough, but I got my message. The important thing was the people said no to those propositions, no to the way I went about it, and we got together after that election, and we said, let's now work together, and we did. There was a whole new kind of environment. Democrats and Republicans are working together, even though we disagree on issues, but there's a civil way of working together and a give and take and a compromise that we have, like I said earlier, accomplished so much last year.
Could you give us a few examples of political leaders who, like you, have moved beyond partisanship? Any particular names?
Well, I think there are, you know, many people in this country that, you know, believe in the bipartisanship and to work together. I think that it's just that there's a lot of people out there that don't, and they haven't figured out yet that in the end it is not about what is best for your party, but you have to look at what is best for the people. And this is why I said earlier that in the end we are all public servants. That is the important thing always to remember. We have to serve the people, not the party. Even though we come from the party and we get the help from the party to get elected, but in the end, we have to serve the people. And I just met with 50 governors and with the president over at the White House. And I tell you, there is a lot of people that I've talked to. They have a very bipartisan approach, but it's just that some people still haven't yet figured out that that's the way to go.
Right. Anyone in particular, though, that you think is sharing your approach?
There is quite a few, yes.
Such as?
Yes, this is good.
No names, huh?
I don't want to leave anyone out.
Oh, okay. Well, we only have 25 more minutes, so I should get going. Good. Does America need a third political party to counter the partisan wrangling of the Democrats and the Republicans?
If I would see that in Europe, where they have many, many parties in most of the countries, that they have a big advantage and they're doing better with less infighting and orders, I would say yes, if we need a third party. But that's not the case. They have as many difficulties in Europe, and there's as much fighting going on. I think that it doesn't have anything to do with that it's just a two-party system. I think that if you have two parties or five parties, if you keep remembering that you're supposed to serve the people, and if you always remember that you have to do things that are good for the country, and what have you promised during the time that you ran during your campaign? I mean, that's really the important thing. We have to serve the people.
How much does your close relationship with the Kennedy family contribute to your post-partisanship message?
Well, I think that it is very helpful. Let me just say that ever since I have met Maria, I have been exposed to the dialogue of helping people, public service, Peace Corps, Job Corps. I've heard about the Special Olympics and reaching out and helping people that need help. And I think that it really inspired me to get involved with Special Olympics and with after-school programs and becoming the chairman of the President's Council on Fitness, that the whole idea of being a public servant and to give something back to your community, that's, I would say, a large portion of the debate and the discussions that are going in that family. So I really benefited from that and got inspired by that. I think that Teddy has been known to work together with the other side. I mean, just if you think about the bills that have passed, it's always many times with Republicans. So I think that's one of the good examples there.
What is the status of your proposal for universal health insurance, and what's the next step on it?
Well, I think the important thing for us in California is that we insure everybody and that government is not running the health care program and the insurance, but it is the private sector. This is really the private sector where we give certain guidelines. And what is important to us is that everyone participates in this because it's the only way we can create a pool of money so we can also insure those that cannot afford insurance. What is also important is that the insurance companies cover everybody because right now they pick and choose a lot of times. And so if someone has a medical history or anything in their medical history, they may not get insurance. Or if you maybe have insurance, you always have to live in a fear that it gets canceled if you have some kind of an illness. I think it's unfair. But at the same time, you have to be fair to the insurance companies to create a larger risk pool and therefore make sure that it's mandatory to have health care insurance, that everyone has to have it. So those are the kind of issues. And we are now working through that. Democrats have their ideas. Republicans have their ideas. And we are coming together. And I think that this year we will be able to solve the problem, including, and I've had meetings just now. I met with the president personally in his office just before I came over here to talk about that we need the federal government's help to really be able to be successful, to create health care for everybody, because it needs the state also to come in and to be a partner and the federal government to come in and to be a partner.
Great.
But everyone has to be insured.
You have said that, like auto insurance, everyone should have health insurance. But in California, auto insurance premiums are regulated. Should health insurance premiums be regulated as well?
I think that if there's a problem with it, we can go in that direction. But I think right now we feel that by creating a bigger risk pool and having everyone insured, that it will bring the costs down. You don't never forget the fact that right now when you have 6.5 million people that are uninsured in California, someone has to pay for those people. And that means that those that are insured are paying a hidden tax. And that hidden tax alone for businesses is $14.7 billion. And it is for an individual almost $500, and it is for family between $1,200 and $1,400. So we want to bring that hidden tax down, or we want to eliminate that hidden tax and also bring the costs of health care down. This is the objective that we have. We have to get rid of that problem. This is why we want to have everyone insured.
You've discounted the idea of a single-payer system such as Canada has for being too bureaucratic. But some advocates of reform say that actually the real key to cracking down on health costs is to address the overhead and drug company profits. How would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, you must let everyone make their profits. And I think the important thing is that we write the bill in such a way that the costs come down. Right now, as I have said, just in the private sector alone, we have $14.7 billion in hidden costs, in hidden taxes. So we want to reduce the tax. It's all about how can we make it affordable for the people, because you have to have access for the people, so everyone has access for health, to health care, that you have to make it more affordable, and that you take care of those that cannot afford health care. So this is the important thing. But right now the system is a broken system and it doesn't work. That is the bottom line. And we see a lot of people that come from Europe to America to get their surgeries. We see a lot of people coming down from Canada to get their surgeries. We have really the best care. There is no two ways about that. We just have to get a better system when it comes to health care.
Okay, switching over to the topic of immigration. You talked about the idea of a centrist approach on immigration. If you could just flesh out how we get to that point, how the two sides on that issue would have to give to get to that point where we actually have a deal here in Washington on immigration.
Well, like I said earlier, I think that, there's the extremists that think that people should go back home that are here illegally or came here illegally. And let's build a fence. And others think that we should give them amnesty. There is, without any doubt, a middle ground to that. And the question is just, how do we find that middle ground? How do we make it so that we can really, celebrate immigration, but at the same time say, but you did something illegal, and that someone has to earn their citizenship and pay a certain amount, and Congress has to figure out what that should be, what they have to do. But the bottom line is that we cannot. It's not realistic to send everyone back. There's people that have children that were born here, people that have relatives here, and all this. It's too complicated. What we have to do is just be reasonable and bring the two sides together, the two extreme sides, bring them together and come up with something that is workable. And also one of the recommendations that I've made to Secretary Chertoff is don't write it in such a way, the law, and accept it that it's too complicated, because we don't have the people to enforce it. We don't even have the people that enforce the current law as it is. So how do we enforce it when they start writing the bill and says, okay, people that are here 5 years but have only one child born here, they can do this. And the people that are here less than 5 years and 4 years and have two children here, who is going to enforce all of this? It sounds good on paper, but you don't have the people here to enforce it. It has to be simple and straightforward, and it has to be, common sense. That's what it is, rather than always thinking about the politics. If I go to my district and I say I'm going to send the illegals back, then I get some extra votes. Yeah, that's an easy shot. But is it really going to help the country in the end? I mean, we need the workers. We know that. I know as soon as we send 1,000 troops to the borders in California, immediately the farmers came to me and says, now there's 26% less crossings, and I have spoiled crops on my ground, and I don't have anyone to pick them up. I'm losing millions of dollars. So this is the reality of it that you face when you run a state or when you run a country. So you have to deal with all of those things. We need the workers, and that's why I always say that we should have a guest worker program so that companies from America can go and hire people from the outside if they can't find the workers in this country.
Have you seen any signs among Republicans of who have been very critical of the immigration issue, that they're willing to give a little and move toward compromise?
Absolutely. I think that now, with, again, new blood being here in Washington, Democrats and Republicans, I think that we can see, and I just talked to the president also, he sees hope, that he is optimistic that something can get done. I am optimistic that something can get done, that the two parties can come together.
Shifting gears again, California and other Western states today announced an agreement to set up a regional greenhouse gas market. How can Western states ensure that their program is compatible with those in the Northeast and elsewhere in the country?
Well, first of all, I think those partnerships are extremely important. We have had, since we signed AB 32, which means that we are rolling our greenhouse gas emissions back to the 1990 level by the year 2020, and since we have come up with the new carbon fuel standards this year and signed an executive order, all of those things are very powerful. And it sends a message, and it makes now other states become interested in that and forming partnerships. We formed partnerships with nine other northeastern states, for instance, to do a cap and trade, which means, you know, that we will also have a trading mechanism that if you can't meet a certain standard, that you can trade with other states and with other companies and so on. So there's all kinds of great things happening. And now we are just signing a memorandum of understanding, which is with the Western Regional Climate Action Initiative. And this is, again, four states coming together in addition to California, five states all together coming together and forming a partnership. And this, I think all of this is going to signal to the federal government that if they don't create the lead, that the states in those partnerships will create the lead, and that we will create a cleaner environment, you know, take care of our air and of our water, and follow the Kyoto Treaty to a certain extent, and really fight global warming. That's the bottom line.
Are the reforms that you've introduced in California going to be enough to allow the state to reach the Kyoto Protocol levels of gas emissions?
Well, we do our share, and I think that California is it's one of those states that if you look at the globe, it looks like a little spot. But the power that we have doing those kind of things and passing laws that clean the environment goes all over the world. I mean, it has that kind of a power. So we have gotten stories all over the world anytime and every time someone does any speech overseas now about global warming or about fighting global warming or about straightening out and rolling back the greenhouse gas emissions and all of those things. They mention California as an example. So this is a very powerful message that the idea is not just to clean California, but to also inspire other states and to inspire other countries to go in the same direction. Because then China looks at that, and as they learn from that, and they get inspired by that. And we see already the impact. And I tell you, we have a partnership also with Prime Minister Tony Blair, with England. And I think the more we do this kind of partnerships, the better it is, and the more it will put the federal government kind of a notice and say, why don't you do a little bit more in order to clean the air and to fight global warming?
With the major American automakers in near bankruptcy, who will pay for the R&D for the new emission standards?
Well, I think that there's two ways of going, the wrong way, and that will hurt businesses, and there's the right way, which will help businesses. We have created all kinds of different businesses in California because of the green technology or the clean technology. And I think that is the idea, that it creates jobs, it creates businesses, new technologies is developed. And so this is what we see in California. We have not seen at all we have not seen businesses move away from California because of it. We have literally seen the opposite. And it's amazing what is going on right now, because we literally, when I did signed an executive order for the new carbon standards, fuel standards, we had the executives of oil companies sit there together with the environmentalists, because what we have done is we still have this cap and trade, which is a right balance between protecting the environment and at the same time protecting the businesses and the economy. So this is what we are trying to do. It's like with everything, there's a fine line, and you don't want to go too far to the left or too far to the right. You want to stay right in the center, and this is what is important here.
You have come out in support of toll roads paid for by the private sector. Please explain how such agreements will avoid a clash between the motives of public agencies and those of private investors, and should foreign companies be allowed to invest in American roads?
Well, absolutely. I think it is very clear that when you manage a state, you see very quickly that the big money is in the private sector, not in the public sector. So if that is the case, then we should let the private sector really build the roads rather than us building the roads. There's a way of doing that. I think the private sector can build the buildings, they can build the tunnels, they can build bridges, they can do all of those things because they like to invest. The key thing is just to have the right guidelines for them and the right partnership. But I mean, I think that takes the responsibility away from the states and hands it over to the private sector. They have to manage it, they have to maintain the roads, and they can charge them a certain fee for people to use it. So a user pays. It's like driving into a parking garage, you pay for parking your car there. It's the same, like you pay for that road because you use that road. Maybe someone that lives up in San Francisco doesn't use that road in Orange County, so why should that person pay for that road? So that's, I think, a much better way to go. And so we are encouraging public-private partnerships.
Mm-hmm. And how about foreign ownership of those roads?
Yes, absolutely. I think that people from foreign companies should be able to invest in it, yes.
Nancy Pelosi and California's congressional delegation like their districts the way they are, according to Speaker Nunez. Does this kill your redistricting reform plan, or can it come back in some way?
No, not at all. I mean, of course, I think it's very clear that politicians love their gerrymandered districts, you know, that they just love to sit there and not having to campaign. There's a lot of them. In California, for instance, you know, we have had out of, I think, 500 and some seats, congressional and legislative seats, there were only four changes in those seats over this last election cycle, the last two election cycles. So as I have said, there's more turnover. There was more turnover in the Habsburg Empire than there was, you know, with our legislative seats. I mean, that is the problem that's going on. And I think that creates, because, you know, the way they've drawn the district lines is that it creates that kind of a, you know, that the right is going more to the right and the left is going more to the left because, you know, there is no competition within that district. Now, there's some districts that have competition between Democrats and Republicans, but there's a lot of districts that don't, and I think that's not healthy, and we have to change that, and this is why we should draw the district lines. Not that the Democrats win more seats or the Republicans win more seats. Hopefully, it turns out to be even the same amount of seats, but just that we redraw the district lines so there's more competition and actually people have to follow through and keep their campaign promises, otherwise they get voted out. But if someone is a Republican and he has 80% of Republicans in the district, he doesn't have to ever worry about, or she doesn't have ever to worry about getting voted out because there's no chance. So there's no competition. So those are the things we want to change. And, you know, we are right now in the middle of negotiating with Speaker Nunez and with Senator Parada and with the Republican leaders in California. So we will come up with something that we can put it on the initiative and let the people make their choice then.
How did your meeting with President Bush go, and what did you talk about?
We talked about, well, first of all, we have the governor's conference right now in town where we have all the governors here, and it always starts out on Sunday night with a wonderful White House dinner and with music, and then the next morning is always a three-hour session where, you know, the Secretary of Education, Secretary of you know, the Interior, and of all the different secretaries and also military, you know, leaders come in and give briefings to the governors about the situation that we are in and the kind of areas where we can work together and which direction the government wants to go. And so, and of course, a lot of the information is clear from the State of the Union address, but there's some detailed stuff that was not clear. And you have a chance to ask questions there and so on. And then I had a chance to go and meet the president in the Oval Office and talk a little bit about what is something that is extremely important for California, and that is health care. That we, the only way that we can solve our healthcare problem is by having the help from the federal government. So I told him that I have a meeting tomorrow with Secretary Leavitt, and we would talk about that. Can he put his stamp of approval on that to make sure that our state is successful in reforming a broken healthcare system? Because if our state is successful and if we get the federal government's help, then all the other states will follow and reform their own, and the federal government doesn't have to get involved in that. Only by federal government has already, Bush has made a great proposal, which is the tax deductions, which I think will be very helpful and very complementary to our reforms. So it's basically, it was a conversation about working together on that, and I needed his help.
Okay, great. Unfortunately, the governor's going to have to leave in just a few minutes.
Yeah, so. Because I'm so busy. But anyway, go ahead.
You have another governor to meet with, right? Okay. Now we reach a very traditional part of the National Press Club luncheon, the gifts. The coveted National Press Club mug. And
that is the famous windbreaker. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Okay, just one last question.
Okay.
Our last question is a very simple one. We've enjoyed having you here at the NPC today. And if we were to invite you again in a year or so, will you be back?
I'll be back. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, Republican Governor of California, was in Washington to take part in the annual winter meeting of the National Governors Association. He spoke February 26th at the National Press Club. You're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to hear from another California politician who spoke this year at the Press Club, Los Angeles Democratic Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. He's the first Hispanic mayor of Los Angeles, and like Schwarzenegger, Villaraigosa is considered a rising star in his party. When he spoke at the Press Club in January, Antonio Villaraigosa offered a plan for fighting poverty.
I believe that the press has a very important role in a democratic society. I said a few minutes ago that the role of the press is to be skeptical, but not cynical. And what we have in common is that I'm not cynical yet. I believe that people working together can change the world. And I believe that in a democratic society, all of us have a responsibility to give back, that we have a responsibility to serve. And in that vein, I think most journalists and public officials are propelled by the same abiding belief in service. I believe that we all have a responsibility to one another, one that we should take great heed on. 17 months ago, our nation watched in frustration and disbelief as a Category 3 hurricane slammed into the towns and the cities of the Gulf Coast, destroying in its wake untold lives and property, and breaching the mighty levees that guard one of America's oldest and most treasured cities. Storms as fierce as Katrina not only have the power to change the landscape, they may also have a way of removing the camouflage. And in the twisted aftermath of this hurricane and the water overflowing those levees, we were all forced to confront a less than flattering reflection of ourselves. There it was for all of us to see, the naked and painful truth. The truth that for many Americans, despite the most urgent distress calls, the cavalry may not always arrive on time. The truth that in America today, if you're flat broke or flat on your back, you may be flat out of luck in a time of serious jeopardy. And America stood frozen, transfixed on our TV screens. We could all read the lips of those people calling out from the rooftops of the lower Ninth Ward. The lack of an effective evacuation plan was not merely a question of emergency preparedness. In a broader sense, millions of Americans find themselves equally stranded today with no clear or coordinated long-term pathway to a middle-class life. You certainly don't need to go to New Orleans or be from the South to understand the crippling effects of persistent poverty in our country today. From South Los Angeles to the South Side of Chicago, from the South Bronx to Southeast Washington, we see more children growing up in poverty in America than in any other leading industrialized nation. In my city, we have close to 10,000 kids arriving in our public schools every day who don't have a bed for the night. 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education, one-third of Americans, African-American children, still grow up in poverty. 11 million Americans can't read a bus schedule or fill out a job application. And the statistics tell another story as well. They tell us that for many Americans, working full-time just isn't enough in an age of globalism, that more and more middle-class families feel their grasp hopelessly slipping. They see their fates inexplicably sliding down the economic ladder. In the words of Senator Webb in his response to the State of the Union, the middle class of this country is losing its place at the table. With increasing competition from abroad, wages have stagnated or declined for more than 40% of our country's workforce. And millions of people now find themselves questioning the continuing relevance of the basic American idea. The idea that if you work hard, and you play by the rules, you ought to be able to provide a good life for your family. What's more, we've always looked forward to a future with confidence, knowing that your kids will have an even better life. So last January, the U.S. Conference of Mayors established a task force on poverty, work, and opportunity. And we set to work on these important and hard questions. We talked to leading experts in the field. We took ideas from both political parties. We culled through the data and identified the most effective policies and practices. And with every idea, we applied a basic test. We asked, is it grounded in the reality of global economic transformation? Is it proven by practice? Does it have demonstrated bipartisan support? Is there a clear and quantifiable return on investment? And we asked how our investments will be strategically leveraged and aligned in coordination with private, philanthropic, corporate, state, and local dollars. Over the last year, our work converged on two overarching conclusions. First, we came to the belief that the way to fight poverty is to increase the rewards for work. Second, to expand the earning power of our people, we concluded that there's an overriding national need for bold, coordinated, cross-cutting, and transformative strategy, giving Americans the education and skills they need to compete and thrive in the global workplace. And we all know what this means. There's no clearer predictor of economic success, no more powerful weapon against poverty than educational attainment. Members of the Press Club, it's time to move the issue of education reform to the front and center of the national debate. Let's avoid divisive distractions of the past, like teaching intelligent design, and confront the fundamental question of the future. How do we intelligently design and align our policies to give all our people a shot at a good education and a better life? First, we're recommending a substantial new federal investment to guarantee high-quality pre-kindergarten instruction for every child in America. The evidence supporting this investment is abundant and absolute. We know the achievement gap starts before kindergarten. We know that nearly a quarter of our children now live in single-parent households. We know that kids growing up in poverty are three times as likely to drop out. And one recent study projects that $2 trillion in GDP will be generated over the next 2 to 3 generations if we make this one single investment. This is a down payment on America's future that we can no longer afford to postpone. Next, we need to retool our schools. We need to give our kids job skills more relevant in the global workplace. This isn't rocket science, and we can't afford to stay stuck in the past. We can see the macroeconomic trends coming right at us. Let me give an example. As the baby boom generation ages, we know that millions of new full-time healthcare jobs, many with career ladders and family supporting benefits, will open up for the next generation of workers. Meanwhile, planners predict that half of our current stock of buildings will be built and rebuilt in the next 30 years. We need to prepare our workers for the jobs that are coming. So we're recommending that state and local governments commit up to $650 per student for schools adopting a high-quality, standards-based career academy curriculum. It's time to reinvent voc ed with rigorous and relevant instruction, emphasizing career building in fields ranging from graphic design to biomed and information technology to healthcare. But ultimately, this is a knowledge-based economy, and we need to send more people to college and back to college. So we're calling for the creation of a tax-free lifetime learning savings account for every child born in America, where the government would match individual contributions by up to $500 per student per year. Just think about the power of this idea. Imagine if every kid in America knew that no matter who you are or where they come from or what their parents' circumstances, there's a bank account with a balance for them to go to college. We estimate conservatively that by the typical high school graduate's 18th birthday, they'll have $30,000 to invest in education or career training. And let's not be confused. This is not our grandparents' entitlement program. It's an idea that's been championed by both parties, or members of both parties anyway. It demonstrates that big ideas don't necessarily translate into big government. In a nation that has one of the lowest savings rates in the industrialized world, this plan leverages savings by leveraging public investments against the individual initiative and compounding the combination over the life of each child. And our recommendations recognize the need to pay our people what they deserve. We're calling for what the House of Representatives, on a bipartisan basis, has already approved in its first 100 hours, a reasonable increase in the minimum wage. We recommend expanding the earned income tax credit to include more people who are working every day while still struggling to pay the basic necessities of life. Believe me, I say this as one who knows. The future wasn't always so bright for me. Somebody gave me a second chance. Think of what we can achieve when we regain our confidence, if we work together, if we overcome the poverty that exists in America and the poverty of political will that exists here as well.
Antonio Villaraigosa, mayor of Los Angeles, speaking in January at the National Press Club in Washington. Earlier, we heard from the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who spoke at the press club late last month. If you missed part of today's speeches by Antonio Villaraigosa or Arnold Schwarzenegger, or if you would just like to hear them again, you may listen anytime by going to our website, wordforword.org. There, you may also subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to all of our previous programs, including speakers ranging from White House Press Secretary Tony Snow to National Urban League President Marc Morial. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pancava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And we had help this week from Kyle Sisko.
American Public Media.